This episode features discussion of kidnapping, rape, and violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
Her captors seem nicer every day they don't kill her. It's been 50 days. 50 times Patricia was spared.
Well, spared is an overstatement considering she's locked in a closet. Her old life feels like a daydream. Playing with her sisters at Hearst Castle, studying art history in Europe, family vacations to the remote fairy tale cottage in Wintoon, her favorite place in the world.
But now, family and the FBI have abandoned her. From the limited TV news her captors let her listen to, it appears Patricia's parents have given up.
She's down to 87 pounds. She sleeps more every day. It would be so easy to die. But Patricia Campbell Hearst is a fighter. She won't let the Symbionese Liberation Army destroy her. The closet door opens. It's Sin, the leader. He has a proposal. Quote, "The War Council has decided that you can join us if you want, or you can be released and go home again," end quote.
Patricia knows what this really means. Join or die. It's a test. And she has to give him an answer.
This is Hostage, the new Parcast podcast telling the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive. I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy. You can listen to all of Parcast's podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
This is our second episode on the kidnapping of Patricia Campbell Hearst, the Symbionese Liberation Army and FBI Operation HERNAP.
On February 4th, 1974, the Symbionese Liberation Army, or SLA, kidnapped Patricia Hearst from her Berkeley apartment. Last week, we covered the events surrounding the kidnapping.
This week, in part two, we'll track the first 7 weeks Patricia spent as a hostage. We'll dive into the psychological change Patricia underwent as a captive and analyze how the Hearsts and the FBI attempted to negotiate for Patricia's freedom through the historic People in Need program.
After 2 months as a hostage, Patricia joined the group that kidnapped her and went on the run. On next episode, we'll examine how she was held hostage not by force, but by fear. Alongside the SLA, Patricia robbed banks, built bombs, and shot at innocents. She was a rebel and a terrorist. But did she have a choice?
After Patricia Hearst's kidnapping on February 4th, 1974, the police were alerted almost immediately. They didn't try to track the cars, but instead focused on making sure the men who'd been attacked, Patricia's fiancé, Stephen Weed, and her neighbor, Steve Swanaga, were okay. The authorities learned everything they could from witnesses and notified the Hearst family.
They put a press embargo on the situation, which seems impossible now, but was common in breaking crime stories in the 1970s. The police wanted to get ahead of it. Randy Hearst told the reporters at the family paper, The Examiner, quote, "Don't do anything that could get Patty hurt."
Since kidnapping is a federal crime, the FBI special agent in charge of San Francisco, Charlie Bates, visited the Hearst Mansion in Hillsborough, California, on February 5th. He brought Agent Monty Hall, who he put in charge of the case.
The authorities realized the SLA committed the crime after finding their signature cyanide bullets at the scene, and deduced that Patricia had probably been taken hostage so she could be traded for the SLA members in prison, Joe Ramiro and Russ Little.
Hall arranged to have an agent at the Hearst home at all times, in case the SLA tried to contact them. They named the operation HERNAP, and began interviewing people who knew Patricia. They learned everything about her.
Unfortunately, it was hard to learn anything about the SLA. The people who had information, young members of the counterculture, wouldn't give the FBI the time of day.
Compounding that, the Bureau's abuse of power under J. Edgar Hoover had recently come to light, and the FBI was unpopular with the general public. So even those who weren't sympathetic to the SLA didn't help. All of this hindered the investigation and left the FBI in the dark.
They had no leads on the SLA's location. No idea where Patricia Hearst might be. All they could do now was wait for a ransom note.
Waiting around sounds counterintuitive, but veteran hostage negotiator Gary Nessner has stressed that negotiations go smoothest when negotiators wait and talk instead of reacting and retaliating. Letting time elapse is often the best way to save lives.
For 3 days, the Hearsts and the FBI waited. On Patricia's first day locked in a closet, a member of the SLA put a portable radio in there with her and turned up the volume, so she wouldn't overhear their conversations. Blindfolded, all Patricia could sense was loud noise and a rotten smell. She soon realized the smell was coming from the old mattress they'd given her to sleep on.
She tried to stop herself from crying, but every time she calmed down, someone would yank open the door to check on her. Then they'd close it and leave her alone again.
After some time, the door opened, and it stayed open. Donald DeFries introduced himself as the General Field Marshal Sin of the Symbionese Liberation Army. He informed her she'd been arrested by one of many SLA field units and asked if she knew what the SLA was.
Patricia realized they were the people responsible for Marcus Foster's murder. She'd seen it in the news. Worried for her life, Patricia quickly decided to play dumb. It'd be safer. If she said anything, she might anger them, and she did not want to anger her captors. Unfortunately, DeFries was obsessed with gaining notoriety. So hearing that someone hadn't heard of him set him off on an angry rant, where he proudly explained that the SLA had murdered Marcus Foster with cyanide bullets, and that they'd kidnapped Patricia as an act of war.
DeFries told Patricia he'd release her after negotiation with her family, and made it clear that her fate was tied to that of Joe Romero and Russ Little. If they died, she'd die.
Patricia described DeFries as angry during this time. Angry that she didn't know who he was, and angry that no news outlet was covering the kidnapping. As we mentioned last week, DeFries was the terrorist group's opportunist. According to former FBI hostage negotiator Thomas Strenz, the opportunist is an ambitious felon with strong narcissistic traits. They use the terrorist group to fulfill their personal agenda and gain power. That's what we see in DeFries.
Venting his frustration, he went off on Patricia, bragging about the SLA's worldwide influence and their armies.
Both of which were non-existent. DeFries was posturing, trying to make himself sound important. After a while, Patricia worked up the courage to ask when she would go home.
Oh, you want to get home for your birthday, eh? He grinned at her.
He knew her birthday was in 2 weeks. What else could DeFries know about her? Psychologist Robert Lifton, who examined Patricia and testified at her trial, noted, quote, "They not only controlled all communication going in and out, and especially during the first few months, but also gave her the sense that they were omniscient. They knew everything, all the details about her family, their holdings, about her past life. And she began to get the sense that they knew. She said to me, I confessed to anything because they seemed to know everything about me anyhow," end quote.
DeFries used the knowledge the SLA had dug up about Patricia as power. He gave her the impression that he'd know if she was lying and punish her if she did.
He proceeded to interrogate Patricia, asking questions about her family and their assets. But she had no idea how much money her relatives made, if they held stocks, or even what they did at work every day. When she couldn't answer, DeFries verbally abused her. He accused her of withholding information.
He claimed Randy Hearst and the Hearst family were enemies of the people, and that the police and anyone on their side were bourgeois pigs. He said Patricia was one of these enemy pigs herself.
Insisting anyone outside the group is the enemy is a common tactic dangerous personalities use to control people, according to former FBI profiler Joe Navarro. The police, the FBI, the Hearsts, those were the real enemies. If Patricia was on their side, she too was despicable and deserved punishment.
Now, this is nonsense, but the SLA believed it and quickly began drilling the "if you aren't with us, you're against us" mentality into Patricia's head.
Through this first day, Patricia refused to eat, worried about what poisons her food might be spiked with.
But the SLA explained they didn't actually want to kill her. Only the FBI would do that. SLA member Angela Atwood finally convinced Patricia to drink water by sipping it herself first.
Where DeFries was all about revolution and violence, Atwood blathered on about her boyfriend, arrested SLA member Joe Ramiro, and what a hero he was. She was the girl in love, friendly and a little silly. Atwood gave the SLA a human face, laying the groundwork for Stockholm Syndrome.
On Tuesday, February 5th, 1974, not quite 24 hours after kidnapping Patricia, the SLA sent a communique to KPFA, a local radio station. The communique included a letter to be read on air, and proof the SLA really had Patricia in the form of her credit card.
Notably, DeFries only sent this communique because he felt the story wasn't getting attention. He had no idea about the press embargo, and the lack of news coverage angered him.
However, the mailing wasn't received and opened until February 7th. As a result, the Hearst family waited for nearly 3 days with no word from Patricia's kidnappers. During this time, the Hearsts were desperate and devastated. Patricia's father, Randy Hearst, hired 3 secretaries to answer the phones around the clock. He consulted psychics, swamis, whoever claimed they could help.
Randy believed that anyone could be an SLA informant or messenger in disguise, so he opened his door for whoever knocked. When the SLA's message was read over the radio, Randy was at the ready. He'd do whatever it took to rescue Patty.
But the message didn't tell him how to get his daughter back.
There was no attempt at negotiations yet. The message was filled with information the FBI already knew. The SLA had Patricia and were keeping her alive. The letter assured her safety so long as no one attempted to rescue her from the SLA's headquarters. And all communications by the SLA were published in the newspaper in full. It ended like every communique from the SLA.
Death of the fascist insect that preys upon the life of the people.
The SLA's goal was apparent. They weren't holding Patricia hostage for money. They were holding her hostage for a platform.
And Randy Hearst gave them that platform. He had the full communique published in the Examiner. Off the Hearst's cue, every newspaper in America did the same. The SLA's message was everywhere.
DeFries had what he wanted. Now all Randy Hearst could do was return to hoping Patty was still alive. Next, we'll continue tracking the negotiations between the Hearsts and the SLA. Now back to the story.
After the February 7th, 1974 publication of the SLA communique, the next few days were quiet to the outside world, but they were loud to Patricia Hearst.
Still blindfolded and locked in the closet, Patricia could hear her captors running military-style drills at all hours of the day and night. They kept the radio running so she wouldn't overhear conversations, turning it off when they wanted to talk to her, or rather, indoctrinate her.
Donald DeFries and his follower, Willie Wolfe, spent hours sitting outside the closet, reading leftist literature to Patricia. If they didn't feel like reading from the likes of Marx or Mao, they'd rant. Through this, Patricia learned of their grand plans to use terrorism to spur a violent anti-capitalist revolution. She paid close attention, not because she had any interest in politics, but to learn how her captors thought and use that information to stay out of trouble.
Of course, the SLA was on to this and tried to keep both Patricia's contact with the SLA and any way for her to identify them to a minimum.
At the beginning, DeFries decided that only he, Angela Atwood, Nancy Ling Perry, and Willie Wolfe were allowed to interact with Patricia. Ling Perry was charged with keeping Atwood from talking too much, and Wolfe was chosen because his upper-class background was closest to Patricia's.
So Patricia was trapped, tied up, unable to see anything, and only allowed to talk to certain people about certain subjects. This set up an environment for what Dr. Margaret Thaler Singer, who later analyzed Patricia, called coercive persuasion.
Well, that's a more technical term for brainwashing.
Dr. Singer listed six conditions that create an atmosphere for coercive persuasion. Number one, keep the person unaware that there is an agenda to control or change the person and their thoughts.
Patricia believed these readings and rantings were DeFries and Wolfe bragging and entertaining themselves, not an attempt to change her views on politics.
Condition 2, control time and physical environment. A study published in the American Journal of Psychology found that sensory deprivation, like being kept blindfolded in a dark closet, increases suggestibility. That's certainly what happened here. The longer she went without seeing, the more Patricia believed what the SLA told her.
Condition 3, create a sense of powerlessness, fear, and dependency.
Patricia was only given two small meals a day and was constantly monitored. When she had to use the bathroom, she had to wait for them to lead her to it. And when they did, SLA members watched. Patricia later recalled that she had never felt so degraded and vulnerable. She feared for her life.
By February 8th, only 4 days into the kidnapping, the SLA fully achieved this sense of powerlessness in their captive. They realized she was too scared of their guns to try to run away, so they untied her. Even with her hands free, Patricia kept her blindfold on, because the SLA told her to.
We'll point out the other conditions of coercive persuasion that Patricia was subjected to when we get to them in the story. The point here is the quote-unquote brainwashing had started.
From February 8th through 12th, the SLA worked on their next communique. They didn't think they could get their imprisoned members, Russ Little and Joe Ramiro, in a hostage exchange right off the bat, so they decided to ask for a gesture of good faith. If it worked, then they'd negotiate to trade Patricia. As long as the Symbionese Liberation Army had Patricia, they had America's attention, and they were going to take advantage of that.
Bill Harris, one of the many actors in the group, who fancied himself more of a Robin Hood than a Che Guevara, came up with the gesture of good faith. It was a food giveaway. $70 worth of food for any person on any form of welfare in California. The others agreed to it and determined that instead of a written message, they'd send a tape recording, and they'd put Patricia on the recording to assure it was played on every TV and radio station.
DeFries recorded a 20-minute diatribe about the SLA's intentions and demands. Here's a clip.
And speaking personally for myself and as a father of two children, I wish to say to Mr. Hearst and Mrs. Hearst that I, as well as the forces under my command through the authority of the court of the people, are not savage killers and madmen, and we do hold a high moral value to life. We value life very deeply and with all the spirit that we as human beings can bring forth in our hearts. But speaking as a father, I am quite willing to lose both my children if by that action I could save thousands of white, black, yellow, and red children from a life of suffering, exploitation, and murder. And I am therefore quite willing to carry out the execution of your daughter to save the life of starving men, women, and children of every race.
In addition to threatening Patricia's life, he assured that the Symbionese Liberation Army was willing to die for their cause.
The tape of DeFries and Patricia, a copy of the SLA Constitution, a 16-point overview of the SLA's goals, and written instructions for the food giveaway were anonymously delivered to the KPFA radio station.
When they told her about the good faith gesture food giveaway, Patricia pointed out that it might not go very well. She thought people might not want to take charity or might not accept the food because it was the result of extortion.
When she voiced this, Ms. Moon Saltysik, who was newly allowed to talk to Patricia, yelled at her. Later that night, DeFries came into the closet and sexually abused Patricia. This was the first time he'd touched her. And he made it clear that this was punishment for disrespecting her SLA sister.
Patricia learned quickly that if she said anything the SLA didn't like, DeFries would hurt her. This exemplified condition number 4 of Dr. Singer's list: suppress old behavior and attitudes. When she expressed an opinion they didn't like, they punished her. On February 12th, this tape-recorded message from the SLA went public, with Patricia Hearst's voice loud and clear.
Quote, "Mom, Dad, I'm okay," end quote.
When Randy Hearst heard his daughter's voice on the tape, his heart both leapt and sank. Yes, she was alive, or at least had been alive on February 8th, as proved by Patricia's reference to current events in Kuwait.
However, the good faith gesture demanded was impossible. The deadline for the food giveaway was February 19th. That gave them just 1 week to organize food for all California welfare recipients, approximately 5 million people. At $70 per person, the total projected cost came out to $400 million. And that's in 1974 dollars.
Sure, the Hearst family had money, but Randy didn't have access to most of it. He and his siblings lived on allowances from the Hearst Trust, which was managed by professionals. He'd have to figure out an alternate plan.
Randy knew his daughter and the SLA were waiting on his response. In the communique tape, Patricia said, quote, "The SLA is very interested in seeing how you're taking this, Dad, and they want to make sure that you are really serious and listening to what they are saying. And they think that you've been taking this thing a lot more seriously than the FBI. It's really up to you to make sure that these people don't jeopardize my life," end quote.
Note that while Patricia spoke the words in the communiques, she didn't write them. DeFries and the others told her what to say and then made her put their messages in her own words. Patricia's comment about her life being in jeopardy was really DeFries' shielded warning.
On February 13th, 1974, Randy and Kathy Hearst had a press conference in front of their mansion. Quote, "Patty, I hope you're listening." He began by addressing his daughter directly, then moved on to a careful explanation, the type fathers often give to their children when the kids ask for something impossible, like a pony for Christmas or $400 million worth of perishable food.
He explained that he'd get back to the SLA in 24 to 48 hours with a counteroffer and decried how difficult it was to communicate over delayed letters. He ended his statement by swearing that no one would come after the SLA with guns, which was an attempt to assure his daughter's safety.
By addressing her directly, calling her Patty, and asking to speak to her on the phone instead of by recorded messages, Randy did exactly what hostage negotiator Thomas Strenz recommends, humanizing the hostage. By talking about Patty as a person, not an asset, Randy could slowly influence the SLA to consider her in the same light. Strand states that this humanizing elicits a reverse form of Stockholm syndrome, wherein the captors bond with their hostages and begin to like them. If the captors know and like the hostages, they're much less likely to kill them.
The effort to humanize Patricia worked. Shortly after Randy's first press conference, Patricia noted that DeFries walked into the closet and called her Patty, instead of the demeaning nicknames he'd been using. Unfortunately, Patty was only used by her family and closest friends, and hearing a special nickname used by a hostile stranger tormented Patricia. But it was still the beginning of the change in her relationship with her captors.
A few hours after the initial conference, Randy, still thinking only of his daughter's safety, realized that his statement came off as haggling, which was not the intent. He got back in front of the cameras and assured the world he'd do everything in his power to set up the type of program they're talking about, despite not having $400 million or even a full week to set things up.
Randy Hearst may not have had $400 million, but he did have upper-class connections. He looked for America's best food bank and found a Seattle food bank called Neighbors in Need. Within 3 days, Peggy Mays, the woman who ran Neighbors in Need, and A. Ludlow Kramer, the Washington Secretary of State, were sitting at the Hearst dining room table cooking up a food distribution plan they called People in Need.
That same day, February 16th, the SLA put out another communique, including another message spoken by Patricia. Quote, first, about the good faith gesture, there was some misunderstanding about that. It was never intended that you feed the whole state. So whatever you come up with, basically, is okay. And just do it as fast as you can, and everything will be fine. End quote.
She went on, repeating political propaganda, which was obviously scripted by DeFries and Ling Perry. The tone of the recorded communiques is an odd mix of passionate radical and bored rich girl. There are a lot of ums and awkward pauses amid the propaganda, though the tiniest bit of Patricia's frustration and spirit shone through when she berated her mom for wearing black on TV because it made it look like Patricia died.
But Randy and Kathy Hearst took the tape as a positive sign. They could make the good faith gesture, donate food, and save their daughter.
After terse calls with his bankers and the Hearst Foundation, Randy was able to rustle up $2 million, which would be over $10 million today. He personally contributed $500,000, and the Hearst Foundation donated $1.5 million. To mitigate the fact that this was less than 10% of what was asked, Randy retained William Koblenz, a top lawyer, to represent Russ Little and Joe Ramiro. He announced this all to the press.
Hiring a lawyer for Little and Ramiro was the best move to assure Patricia's safety. The SLA had made it clear that Patricia would only be harmed if Little and Ramiro were harmed. Even though the SLA had asked for food to be distributed on February 19th, the first distribution, of several, was planned for February 22nd.
The organization, led by Peggy Mays and A. Ludlow Kramer, set up shop in a warehouse decorated with pictures of Patricia. People in Need attempted to coordinate with groups the SLA had listed as their contemporaries, including the Black Panthers, who said no, the United Prisoners Movement, who said yes, and the Nation of Islam, who sold them eggs.
They found volunteers in Patricia's Berkeley classmates, even though, ironically, none of them actually knew her. They rejected an offer of help from Jim Jones and the People's Temple, who attempted to grift the money. But they did find a volunteer bookkeeper in Sarah Jane Moore, who, less than 2 years later, tried to shoot President Ford.
It was a diverse crowd, but the program was coming together.
Patricia's 20th birthday passed on February 20th, 1974. She spent it in a closet. At this point, she wished she'd been taken by normal kidnappers, those who just wanted to trade her for money with no absurd demands. She'd reflect on happy times, her early life, and try to stifle her cravings for pizza.
She'd never loved pizza, but on a diet of mung beans, rice, and peppermint tea, Patricia craved hearty meals. The peppermint tea was the worst. The smell made her sick. She lost count of the days she spent in the closet, sleeping more and more, and still perpetually exhausted. She dropped down to under 100 pounds. Even with her slim 5'3" figure, she was too skinny.
At this point, Patricia survived only because she was dedicated to doing just that. She couldn't die like this. She wouldn't let herself. They'd let her go soon, right?
Not quite. On February 21st, the day before the first People in Need donation was set to run, DeFries issued another communique.
The Hearst Empire has attempted to mislead the people and to deceive them by claiming to put forth a good faith gesture of $2 million. This amount is not at all a good faith gesture, but rather is an act of throwing a few crumbs to the people, forcing them to fight over it amongst themselves.
He demanded that the food be given to anyone who asked, not just welfare recipients, and that the program be funded with another $4 million on top of the $2 million in place.
If this demand wasn't answered, all communications regarding Patricia's release would stop until Little and Ramiro walked free.
Oh, and the additional $4 million had to be donated within the next month.
DeFries ended his pre-recorded communique with a powerful tirade, a speech so full of slurs we won't repeat it here.
There was still no word of an actual hostage trade.
At this point, California Governor Ronald Reagan had made it clear that Ramiro and Little would not be traded, pardoned, or released early. The Hearsts had no more money to offer. The FBI had no real leads.
What could Randy Hearst do?
Up next, we'll hear Randy's response.
Now back to the Hearst kidnapping.
On February 22, 1974, Patricia Hearst had been held hostage for 18 days. Her captors had made impossible demands.
The press camped out in front of the Hearst's mansion, nailing their phones to trees in the front yard. The FBI remained publicly silent. Everyone was waiting on Randy Hearst.
He stepped outside his house, in front of the microphones, lights, and cameras, and spoke to the Symbionese Liberation Army.
He said, quote, "The size of the latest demand is far beyond my financial capability. Therefore, the matter is out of my hands," end quote.
Randy stepped away from the podium, and Charles Gould, a representative of the Hearst Foundation, a charity organization, stepped in. Gould said that the Hearst Foundation would provide an additional $4 million in funding for people in need if, and only if, Patricia was released. The group offered $2 million upon Patricia's safe release and another $2 million the following January.
Gould made a point to remind everyone that the Hearst Foundation and Hearst Corporation were not controlled by the Hearst family, and then said that, quote, "No more funds will be committed by the foundation or corporation under any circumstance," end quote.
Inside their headquarters in Daly City, the SLA cruelly made Patricia Hearst listen to the whole press conference.
DeFries said, quote, "I told you your father didn't give a damn for your life. Now you can hear it for yourself and see we've been telling the truth," end quote.
They wanted her to feel abandoned and alone, the daughter of a father who wouldn't save her. In Patricia's mind, her family had given up. This is another example of the fourth point in coercive persuasion, repressing old attitudes. The SLA was determined to break the bond between Patricia and her family. If she thought they'd abandon her, she'd be more likely to abandon them. At this point, Patricia said she could foresee no hope of rescue.
It didn't help that DeFries decried the latest offer as a trick. He didn't trust the Hearst Foundation to actually donate the second $2 million once Patricia was returned. DeVries knew all his power lay in having a hostage and the publicity around it. He wasn't going to give it up yet.
In Psychological Aspects of Crisis Negotiation, Strenz writes, quote, "The most unique aspect of the extremist hostage taker is his or her interest in favorable media coverage," end quote. DeVries believed that the SLA would get all the credit for people in need feeding thousands. After all, each box of food bore the seven-headed cobra logo. Each person who received free food was a new person who might think positively of the SLA's cause, and those who saw it on the news might think the same. It's twisted, since his way of getting people the food was kidnapping, raping, and terrorizing a teenage girl, but that was his logic.
Patricia described the SLA as, quote, "absolutely publicity crazy." Sin came to believe he was all-powerful, and his followers, all seven of them, lived in the same fantasy world. They were following their leader to glory or to death, end quote.
Since it would be days before the SLA replied, Randy's only choice was to move forward with people in need as planned. He had to show them he was committed to doing everything he could. He wasn't able to add more money to the giveaway, but he did make it clear that the food boxes would be available to anyone who showed up at a distribution location, regardless of their income.
People in need was unprecedented. No one had ever given away food on such a large scale and so quickly.
However, the first distribution was a disaster.
At noon on February 22, 1974, People in Need was set to distribute boxes of food from Nation of Islam properties in East Oakland, East Palo Alto, San Francisco, and Richmond, California.
Outside Your Black Muslim Bakery in Oakland, about 5,000 people lined up hours in advance.
Delayed trucks and immense crowds resulted in a riot, with hundreds of pounds of food wasted, thousands of people left unfed, and 21 hospitalizations.
All of it aired on national news.
Distribution went much more smoothly in the other three locations, but the failure in Oakland and the ensuing lawsuits jeopardized the entire plan.
That night, the Hearsts were sick with worry. Had they lost their chance to get Patty back? Hoping there might be some way to salvage people in need, Randy Hearst called his lawyer, William Koblentz. Koblentz did some thinking and called David Feckheimer, a PI who had been helping with security at the People in Need warehouse. Koblentz wanted a new security plan to prevent another riot.
Feckheimer suggested they enlist Delancey Street.
Delancey Street was an unconventional rehab program helping former prisoners, gang members, and addicts turn their lives around. Randy Hearst met with the Delancey Street's founder, John Marr. Marr was committed to making a difference in the world and liked the idea of people in need. He was more than happy to lend the services of 300 Delancey Street residents and 30 trucks.
He just had two conditions. Marr said, quote, "We will not accept any payment, and we will not accept any publicity," end quote.
The next week, 300 bald addicts and ex-cons helped keep the peace during the People in Need food distributions. They all went much more smoothly.
Randy Hearst had given all that he could, but he didn't hear a word from the SLA.
February 22nd through March 3rd, 1974, saw a nine-day gap in communications. In Randy Hearst's mind, the ball was in DeVries' court. But DeVries didn't have a plan beyond people in need. He remained silent to the public. He was busy talking to Patricia.
Through their conversations, Patricia grew closer to her captors. She learned what they cared about, acted like she agreed with their political statements, and even made jokes at the expense of her fiancé, Stephen Weed. Atwood, Ling Perry, and Wolf soon saw that Patricia was feisty and charming.
They liked that she was a rebel herself, who had an illicit teacher-student relationship, gone to Berkeley against her parents' wishes, and indulged in marijuana. She was more like them than they thought.
On March 3rd, one day before the one-month anniversary of the kidnapping, Randy and Catherine Hirst got on TV with a request for the SLA.
Randy asked if Patricia could write to her parents, referencing the Geneva Convention, which allowed for that. He was flattering the SLA. They had mentioned the Geneva Convention multiple times in their communications and insisted they were obliged to follow it, as if they were a country and not just eight well-armed 20-somethings.
Ignoring her daughter's request, Catherine wore all black again. While Randy Hirst was willing to bend to demands and flatter the hostage takers, Catherine remained resolute.
When he saw the news, DeFries responded by amping up the SLA's military drills and reiterating the dangers of the FBI. He took Randy's latest overture to mean that the FBI was planning a raid soon, and the SLA had to prepare for a showdown.
Much like his rivalry with Marcus Foster, this was all in DeFries's head. The FBI still had no clue where the SLA was. DeFries was so convinced they were in danger, he gave Patricia an unloaded gun so she could defend herself from the FBI pigs.
This was the next step in coercive persuasion. Put forth a closed system of logic. The SLA convinced Patricia the FBI would kill her if given the opportunity, and if she didn't obey them, the SLA would kill her too. They didn't tell her the second part directly, but as she recalls in her memoir, she understood the threats.
Amid the training, the SLA worked on a new communique, though this one with a different voice, Angela Atwood's.
On the tape, which was released March 9th, Atwood reiterated how disappointed the SLA was with the Hearst Empire. She criticized their deceit, corporate trickery, media censorship, and oddly, Randy Hearst's investments in Safeway. Atwood continued.
After extensive nationwide intelligence and analysis by the Symbionese War Council, it became clear that the fascist corporate state and its chief domestic police agency, the FBI, and other police state agencies and institutions intended to set up Patricia Hirst for execution in order to discredit and isolate the people's forces. This is shown by the deliberate disregard for the health, life, and safety of Joseph Romero and Russell Little, and the plans of police state agencies to see to it that Patricia Hirst is killed. Communication between POW Patricia Hirst and her family will come only after the immediate creation of the necessary mechanisms whereby Russell Little and Joseph Romero can communicate via live national TV with the people and the SLA concerning the full scope of their physical health and all the conditions of their confinement.
And, of course, nothing would be done unless this tape was published in full.
Later in the tape, Patricia speaks, with markedly increased confidence and clarity from her earlier communications. Her bored disinterest is replaced with, not passion, but a new firmness. Amid SLA demands and derision of the FBI, she berates her parents, saying, quote, "What you had to say sounded like you don't care if I ever get out of here," end quote.
Over time, the tapes show Patricia getting more comfortable spouting SLA propaganda. The group had been teaching her their values and forcing her to repeat them into a tape recorder for nearly a month now. This fulfilled Dr. Thaler Singer's final condition for coercive persuasion: instill new behaviors and attitudes. Every day, they pulled her away from being a Hearst and pushed her towards being a member of the SLA.
They pulled her into their ranks in a sick, twisted way. As a policy, all members of the SLA were sleeping with each other, and it hit a point where they didn't see Patricia as different. Willie Wolf and Donald DeFries began raping Patricia. She was horrified, but she was worried that fighting back would result in her death.
SLA members always insisted it was consensual that Patricia even initiated the encounters. They said Patricia and Wolf were even a couple, but obviously Patricia didn't have a choice. She was held captive. There was nowhere for her to go. She was raped.
Agreed. But it's interesting to note that the SLA members saw her more and more as a member of the group, someone they could have a relationship with, someone they could convert.
On March 13, 1974, Catherine Hurst accepted her reappointment as a regent of the University of California, the same regent position the SLA had repeatedly taken her to task for. Since she advocated for cracking down on student activists, the SLA believed her work as a regent exemplified the worst aspects of the ruling class, and everyone knew this.
In fact, Governor Ronald Reagan offered to hold the position for Catherine until Patricia was safely returned to avoid a scandal.
Catherine refused to wait, which appalled her husband, her daughter, and the SLA. Catherine saw this as a stand against the hoodlums who took her daughter, a show of strength, and a refusal to bow to their demands. Randy Hurst had washed his hands of the situation, and now Catherine was ignoring it.
Hearing this news, Patricia felt completely abandoned. There wasn't another press conference. There was no more money given to people in need. There were, effectively, no more negotiations.
According to Patricia's account, Sin came into the closet one night soon after this. He whispered to her, as if he had a secret, quote, "It may be coming down to a decision about you pretty soon. I was thinking, maybe I could go to the War Council and convince them to let you join us. That would be better than getting killed. You can join us and fight with us. And that would mean you can never go home or ever see your folks or your old friends. Or you can die." End quote.
He left Patricia to consider it.
DeVries had a bigger immediate concern. He was even more convinced that an FBI raid on the Daly City House was imminent. It wasn't. The FBI still had a disturbing lack of leads on the SLA's location. It's not clear how DeVries became so convinced they were in danger.
On March 21st, 1974, the SLA stuffed Patricia in a garbage can. They cut two air holes in the lid and tied it up with ropes. As she stepped in, Soltysik reminded Patricia she had a machine gun, and if Patricia made any noise, there'd be a lot more holes in the garbage can.
They threw the garbage can in the back of a car and drove her to the new safe house at 1847 Golden Gate Avenue in San Francisco, only a mile away from the local FBI headquarters.
Patricia was locked in a new closet, and for a few days, things went back to normal. She was trapped with no way out.
But DeVries hadn't forgotten his new plan, the ultimate coup. Getting a Hurst to join the SLA. He imagined it as an incredible way to bring attention to their cause and sway the public opinion in favor of the Symbionese Liberation Army's ideals.
He sat outside her closet and made her an offer.
Quote, "Well, the War Council has decided you can join us if you want to, or you can be released and go home again," end quote.
Patricia took this in. Would these madmen really let her go? No chance. She was convinced that reality matched DeVries' original offer. Join or die.
She hated the SLA, what they'd done to her, what they stood for. But in the words of Strentz, quote, "The victim's need to survive is stronger than his need to hate the person who has created this dilemma," end quote.
She answered, quote, "I want to join you. I want to fight for the people," end quote. Next time on Hostage, we'll cover Patricia's year on the run. What happens when a hostage robs a bank, shoots at people, or kidnaps someone else? what does the FBI do when negotiations break down? And how do you rescue a hostage who doesn't want to be found?
You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, CastBox, or your favorite podcast directory.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Maggie Admire and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.